morning, Sports Radio 950 KJR. We move into the 7 o'clock hour here on a Red Box Football Friday. And getting us started is Greg Bell, our Seahawks insider. Good morning, Greg.
Hi, good morning, guys.
All right, do we have to rethink our Pete Carroll Coach of the Year comments from yesterday based on what happened last night? Do we have to reshape that conversation at all, Greg? Because I thought you made a great argument yesterday, Greg.
It still applies. it still applies. No, I don't think so. I thought you saw Philip Rivers being at his very best, which is very good. And I will give Coach Lynn credit for going for two on the road against the best team in the AFC, and it worked out for him. Man, that guy was wide open on the conversion. But, yeah, Lynn'll get a few more votes after last night.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we go into this week with a chance to wrap up a playoff spot against the San Francisco 49ers. Would anyone on the roster admit that that would be satisfying to do that on Sherm's new turf?
Yeah, they'll admit it after the game. They might even admit it before, but yeah, there's a little extra spice to it. That is another reason why this prevents it from being just a walk-up again, and they don't even... The trap game is what the word you've heard all week. It's hard to consider that this would be a trap game if you can clinch a playoff berth. And, of course, as I mentioned, the way Pete Carroll does it anyway, every week's a championship opportunity. You say that so much that it becomes somewhat realistic in the truth around the team anyway. And they're still so young. Like Ken Norton said the other day, they're too young to know what the trap game is, most of them on defense especially. So I think it's going to be an ugly game. It's going to be a mucky game. It's going to be on a grass field. It's supposed to 80% chance of raining during the game. So it's probably going to look ugly. And it's Monday morning, we're going to say, well, they didn't do this, they didn't do that, but they're going to be in the playoffs by then. That's how I think it's going to end up.
Greg, I mean, one thing I'm wondering, so we're talking about like some of them, I don't think this team has a mentality right now where they could fall into the trap game. But the thing is, you don't know you fell into a trap game until you fell into it. So, I mean, my point is, you don't. It's a matter of overlooking an opponent, and then all of a sudden you found yourself trapped at the end of the whole ball game. They just whooped these guys, and now they're going to go into their spot, which is going to be obviously a little bit more of an advantage in their direction. How do you see this thing panning out the same way that it did 2 weeks ago, as far as? Is it just mentality? Is it the players going to go do the same thing? Is it the coaching philosophy? How are they not going to find themselves looking up from the ground halfway through this ballgame?
I think it is mentality, Bucky. And the easiest way, the most expeditious way to take care of this is to jump out early. A 3-10 team on the almost to Christmas. There are guys and families that don't want to be there and are just hoping that, I'm talking about the 49ers, there are some guys who just don't want to be there. They want Christmas to show up. Their families are like, hey, Dad, when are you going to be back? And, man, isn't the season over yet? You guys stink. Why are you still playing? There is some of that. And I have seen teams that once you go ahead of them, it's over. And the Arizona Cardinals the last couple of years coming in here have been an example. The Seahawks have not... They jumped out on those guys when they played in Seattle in December, and the Cardinals have been out of the playoffs. And all of a sudden, the Cardinals are like, oh, this might be worth our time to win this game. And then they've won three of the last four here in Seattle. I'm going to be making the same speech before the December 30th game. But if you can jump up on a team anything close to like Seattle did here 2 weeks ago, 20-0 in the first half, it'll be a boat race. And they'll win going away. And there is just I know they're all professionals and they get paid, but around this time of year, especially in this sport, which is so brutal and 60 car crashes every Sunday, and there's just a part of human nature that says, okay, I'm done with this. Let's move on. Can we get to the end of the season, please? And if you can beat it, take a lead on a team early, I think that's where Seattle would make it an easy day for them. If it's a close game at halftime, then they're in for it. And like I said, I think it's going to end up being an ugly game. The atmosphere will not be a factor. Anyone who's not been to Santa Clara, Blue Jean Stadium is as least of a home field advantage as there is in the NFL.
Blue Jean Stadium.
Usually it's 50% Seattle, fans down there anyway, and at that 50% is about 50% of 20,000 people. It looks like a Rainiers game at Cheney Stadium at Tacoma, except the stadium's a little fancier.
Forever in blue jeans. Greg Bell is our guest, talking some Seahawks football. I'm looking at a really lengthy injury report.
Yeah.
Based on a little bit of our conversations that we've had throughout the course of the week, when would Pete, if he would start thinking about resting guys, if that's, you know, and I'm not talking about we don't play Russell. I know that that's not his mantra. But when, you know, you always hear that statement of if it was a playoff game, he'd play. Well, right. It's not a playoff game yet, and this team is very razor close to locking up their playoff spot, and there might not be that big of a difference between 5 and 6. When would you start considering, you know, resting guys with the idea of let's get them healthy for the playoffs?
Right now. There are some guys on the team that they're having that discussion with right now. And what they're really the difference the Seahawks are playing for here the last 3 weeks is at Chicago or at Dallas. And the way it's working out is Dallas is going to get that 4 seed and Chicago's going to get the 3. So if they end up at the 6 seed, they'll go to Chicago. And if they end up at the 5 seed, they'll go to Dallas. Now you can debate which is more preferable. They've beaten Dallas here in Seattle. They lost on the road, given away the game on week 2. Monday night at Chicago, when we talked about they were just malfunctioning on offense because they were throwing it 73% of the time. Russell Wilson threw an interception, gave it away in the outside corner. It just walked into the end zone for the clinching touchdown and made it 24-10 in the fourth quarter. So there's a reason to believe that they can win either way, Dallas or Chicago. A guy like DJ Fluker is an example of what you're talking about. There is no reason to rush him back on a pulled hamstring, a strained hamstring is what Pete Carroll has called it, to play in San Francisco on a muddy track. It's supposed to be raining, like I said, on a grass field. No reason. I would be surprised if he plays. Jordan Simmons will make his third NFL start at right guard. Rashad Penny banged his knee Monday night. Do you need him to play? Probably not. Rest a sore knee so he can play the final couple games or definitely in the playoffs. Then a guy like Doug Baldwin, I would think, would fall into the same category. Yesterday I saw him running around on the practice field almost full go. He ended up being listed as a limited participant. But he looked to me like he's about to play. There's a lot of pride and ego and also status on the team that Doug Baldwin is still trying to hold on to and is still a leader of this team and wants to show by example that he's up for the task of clinching this playoff berth. So I think in Baldwin's case, he'll play. But there'll be this medical/competitive decisions that are right exactly what you're talking about. I think Fluker's going to be an example of that.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the secondary, I mean, last time they faced the 49ers, we've talked about the 400 yards that Mullins put up, and it didn't look too bad doing that. That being said, I think I was right to question the secondary going into this last week's game, and they went out and they showed maybe their best performance as a group in quite some time. How good do you feel right now about the secondary, Shaquille Griffin's play, Trey Flowers, the entire group, as they get ready to face Mullins again 2 weeks after allowing 400 yards to him?
Well, they played well against the Vikings to prove you wrong, Chuck. They made that a top priority. They were trying
to
show you.
Well, they did. I think I was right to question it, but they
did shut me up. So you served the Seattle community well.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome.
All the Seahawks fans appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Tackling improved exponentially against Minnesota. They were tackling players in front of them. They were great on the ball in the air. Shaquille Griffin had a couple of huge pass deflections on third downs that ended drives. Trey Flowers shows that he was a college safety and was tackling. He got beaten on the big play by Stephon Diggs, but I think any corner of the league would have been beaten on. That was such a leaping, great grab by Diggs on the route down the middle of the field for the 48-yard gain, set up Minnesota's only chance to score. Their tackling was the most striking difference between San Francisco and Minnesota. Now, here come the 49ers with a screen game, and I mentioned that Matt Breida is probably not going to play. May play. Questionable ankle injury he's got 2 weeks ago in Seattle. Without Breida, they will definitely just throw the ball and throw screens at him. The Seahawks were so bad against the 49ers in the screen game. Jeff Wilson's going to be coming at the undrafted rookie running back we talked about yesterday. He was very impressive at how hard he runs. he's going to get the ball outside on screens, and the Seahawks are going to have to tackle him. And I think that's the key defensively to this game, is just being better tackling receivers in the open field. It's hard this time of year to practice tackling because they aren't in pads. You're not bringing anybody down. They never practice tackling in any practices back to training camp anyway. So it's all about a mindset. And again, if this team is what it says it is and every week's a championship opportunity, they should have the mindset to close this out and get it done and get a playoff berth. So tackling mentality shouldn't be an issue.
You don't trust this San Francisco offense much, though, do you?
No. It's Nick Mullins, and it's not Jimmy Garoppolo, and no, I don't. And if you don't have Matt Breida, I don't. Most of those 414 yards passing a couple weeks ago came on Dante Pettis' 75-yard catch and run was a complete blown coverage, and then missing 15,000 tackles on screen pass. You take those out, and he throws for 200-something yards, and all of a sudden we're not talking much about Nick Mullins right now.
All right. Well,
let me mention one thing,
yeah,
Chuck.
Yeah, sure.
Frank Clark, elbow injury, a concern. He was limited in practice on Wednesday. You think, okay, he'll be ramping up to go full go by the end of the week. He completely missed practice yesterday, and so did Jerron Reed with an oblique. So the two top pass rushers weren't on the field yesterday. The one caution is it's, of course, a short week. Yesterday was really like a Wednesday, the third day after a game. So I'm not saying they're not going to play, but it's something worth looking in the weekend whether Reed and Clark play.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, man. We appreciate it. Enjoy the weekend, and we will talk to you on Monday.
Happy weekend, you guys. We'll
All right.
See you later.
Greg Bell, our Seahawks insider. It's brought to you by the Michaels Automotive Group, a family-owned and operated dealership that places customer satisfaction as its highest priority. They feature three of America's most popular automotive brands, Toyota, Volkswagen, and Subaru, all located at the same location just off I-90 in Eastgate. I brought up the to start our conversation with Greg this morning, the Coach of the Year debate, and the reason I brought it up because I thought Greg made a really compelling case for Pete Carroll yesterday during the roundtable. We're going to replay that case that he made and kind of put Pete Carroll's coaching job, the job he's done here in 28, in its proper perspective. We'll do that next.
You know. Now back to Football Friday, powered by Redbox, the smarter way to watch and play on your home for college football Saturdays and the NFL. Seattle Sports Radio 950, KJR.
The most famous reindeer of all. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer had a very shiny nose. And if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer.
It's a classic. It's a goodie.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
I just want to say to my buddy Ken, I don't look like Burl Ives.
Oh.
So you can save it. You're real.
Oh, I'm not getting that at all.
You don't see Burl Ives?
I don't see Burl Ives.
Thank
Burl
you.
Burl Ives was an old, like, it was like everybody's grandfather.
So a young Burl Ives.
Do you see Burl Ives?
I don't know what he looked like.
Basically, the snowman in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was made to look like the real person, Burl
okay.
Ives. So Burl Ives was the snowman
Yeah.
in well, then, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and the snowman was made to look like Burl
okay.
Ives.
All right, yeah. I see it.
The narrator, the one that told the whole story?
Yeah.
You don't see it.
So, Burl Jacobson.
He used to sell a lot of tea. Used to sell the merits of tea bagging.
Have a holly jolly Christmas, folks.
See, I think you represent with the red beard over there. You're like Bucky, the red bearded show host.
Okay.
That you represent young Kringle, who I don't think gets enough play in the Christmas story. We always hear about the old guy after he'd already, you know, accomplished all the amazing things in life and became the goat.
Yeah,
of the holiday season.
Of course,
and, you know, we always just celebrate all of his many accomplishments. I mean, there's not a Rushmore for Christmas. It's him and Jesus. They pretty much have the entire thing covered.
Locked down. You got it locked down.
You can make a Rushmore. You can put the wise men up there.
No, you can't. You can't put the wise men up there with those
Jesus?
Two guys. Stop,
Santa. So if you're making a Christmas Mount Rushmore,
no, you can't.
It's a two-man Rushmore.
It's a two-man Rushmore. Actually, it's a one-man Rushmore.
Really?
Yeah, really.
It really is. And Santa gets to kind of kick it.
Right. Santa gets to party there on the weekend.
Yeah, you just hang out a little bit, bud.
Party. He gets to like rent the cabin.
I'm God.
He gets to rent the cabin on the weekends.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but yeah,
one-man Rushmore.
Young Kringle, red-bearded Kringle, is the one that hatched the entire idea for for, you know, this thing that he does.
It's what I do for children.
He doesn't get celebrated enough.
I agree.
I think young Kringle had an amazing idea, and I'm talking about the one that used to go to bars and hit on chicks. That Kringle.
That guy.
Yeah.
Before he didn't need no elves.
I mean, imagine.
He did it by himself.
Imagine you're sitting at the bar, and you're like, hey, can I get you a nog? You know, to some lovely young girl interested in some nog. I'd love to buy you a nog. And then, you know, she's, of course, reluctant.
And a little weird.
Yeah, she's like, I'm not usually attracted to gingers.
Yeah, right. Who is?
And then eventually, it's cold outside.
Eventually she gets to the question, like, what do you do for a living? And you just shrug, and you're like, ah, well, I sort of make toys for all the boys and girls, and I deliver them so that they're happy once a year and that they have something to look forward to. It's not a big deal. Let's not make a big deal out of it.
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal. I go down every chimney in the world.
Pretty much the most charitable human being ever.
Yeah.
Solid pickup line.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's don't paint me with that brush entirely.
That's not who I am.
Yeah, but it's just what I do. It's
kind of what I do. You're right. I like that. I feel a lot more like that than Burl Ives. Yeah. I agree. I'm a young,
red-bearded Kringle. Yeah, game, man.
Ginger game. Kringle.
Yeah.
I'll go with Burl Ives.
No. All right, I'm wearing a Santa costume in here before you heads up.
All right, well, Greg Bell was just with us in our last segment. He joins us every day at 7 o'clock to talk a little Seahawks football. He was also with us yesterday during the roundtable, and we've had a lot of conversations here recently about the job that Pete Carroll has done here in 2018 with the Seattle Seahawks. Some have gone as far as saying it's the best job he may have ever done in his professional coaching career, even though he's won a Super Bowl, even though he's gone to the Super Bowl a couple of times, even though he's the oldest coach in the National Football League and has a pretty impressive resume, that this might be his crowning achievement in terms of what he's gotten out of this particular roster. So we've had discussions about it. We had another one yesterday during the roundtable, and man, did Greg make a compelling case for why Pete Carroll should be the choice.
Coach of the year, people just look at what teams do not think were going to be good that became good, or what teams that were decent became great. In the case of the Chiefs, a playoff team, playoff caliber team the last few years, who now are off the charts, 15, may end up 15-1. Chicago Bears, for instance. Matt Nagy, first-time head coach. They're 9-4. Nobody thought the Bears were going to do anything because they haven't done anything since what Jim McMahon seemed like since he was there in the great defense they had. I'm exaggerating a little bit. But that tends to be the conversation of coach of the year. But let's consider what Pete Carroll did versus Andy Reid, for instance. He completely changed the offense. He said, we're not going to have Russell Wilson throw for 4,000 yards and 34 touchdowns. We can't, because we can't block for him. We did this in the middle of the season after two losses, said we're junking the offense of 73% passes and we're going to run more than anybody in the league. We're going to run 42 times if we have to. And they've done it, and they've won 8 of 11. We're going to junk the defensive coordinator who I had brought up in my system, and I'm going to bring back a guy who I let go and didn't choose him 3 years ago. And, oh, by the way, I'm going to take out all the Hall of Fame players I have on my defense and throw them out at the same time. And I'm going to bring 8 starters in and 11, 8 of 11 new starters on defense.
Is that all?
And, it's not. Oh, by the way, I'm going to change the offensive line, bring in a new line coach with a new system, and junk the way we were evaluating, drafting, and signing linemen, giving it to one guy, Tom Cable, and saying, nope, we're just going to put it back in our scouting department and personnel department and let them pick the linemen and have an offensive line coach, old school offensive line coach, teaching guys to put faces in mud. That's what we're going to do. We're going to drive the guy in front of him and put him in the face in the mud. They've changed all of that while still having a franchise quarterback in his 20s and still having an all-pro middle linebacker. And they win 8 of 11 and are on their way to the playoffs, which they weren't in last year when they had all the Hall of Famers. I just outlined for you the case for Pete Carroll for Coach of the Year versus everybody else who didn't do any of that. The Chiefs didn't change both coordinators and the offensive line system. The Bears did not junk 8 of 11 starters on defense. They added an all-pro, all-world pass rusher in Khalil Mack. So that would be my argument. There is a fatigue across the country of Pete Carroll. There is an East Coast bias. I think Pete Carroll is a quack that think he does things so unconventionally that it would never work outside of the cocoon he's in here in South Alaska. And that is a bias against him. And then there is a segment of the NFL population who believes Pete Carroll should never deserve anything for having thrown from the 1 yard line in Super Bowl 49. Those are all the things that works against the public opinion straw poll about Pete Carroll being coach of the year.
I think it's a terrific argument, and I think you could actually add on to it as well. I mean, I think that you could say, hey, look, nobody was expecting this season out of the Seahawks to be 8-5 and could potentially go 11-5 before all is said and done. And that was with the idea that Earl Thomas was going to be on the team, with the idea that K.J. Wright was going to be healthy and on the team, with the idea that Doug Baldwin was going to be healthy for 16 games. I mean, he's done this without those three players, in essence. I mean, he's had a version of Baldwin, but it's not the version that he'd had in previous years.
Not even close.
Okay? And so, to have made as many difficult decisions, personnel-wise, philosophy-wise, and ones that, and very few that I agreed with, by the way, not that I'm, you know, the man that answers for this, but a lot of people were like, really? You're going to go with Brian Schottenheimer? Right. The rest of the National Football League is going toward Sean McVay and Doug Peterson, and you're going to go toward Woody Hayes? You're going to lean that direction? Yeah. I mean, the rest of the National Football League is like thinking about, as Hugh puts it, the Jetsons. Where's offense going? And in the face of all of this, you've decided, no, somebody go fetch me my buckboard. We're all heading to Sleepy Eye, and we're going to pick up a peppermint stick and an offensive coordinator while we're there, yeah, and maybe a bag of grain. Yeah. All right, we're going to go to the fields. We're going to sow. We're going to reap, and we're going to sow. We're going to go old school on this. I'm going to go medieval on your ass. Right. That's what Pete Carroll decided to do in this offseason, and I think that anybody, and maybe I'm making an excuse for myself, I think anybody had the right to question what is going on here. Well, I mean, you want to go back to a running style offense with a group of running backs that averaged like 2 yards a carry a year ago. And yet, having made difficult decisions on personnel and unusual decisions in terms of strategy, they've worked. Damn near every single one of them has worked. I mean, he's sitting there with he's basically celebrating. He's got to be laughing like the Cheshire Cat at this point. Okay, go ahead and keep criticizing me because this thing's panned out perfectly for me.
There's no way that I think he could even imagine that they would be on the precipice of potentially going 11-5. Now, I mean that's thinking a little bit ahead, but I will say that where they are right now, they're going to make the playoffs. They have kicked people's butts. I mean, they literally have lined up and said, I'm going to whoop your butt. And the way that they do that, honestly, in the face of Sherman leaving and kind of trying to burn the bridge a little bit on his way out, in the face of Earl Thomas, who they thought was going to be here, they wanted him to be here, and he's flipping the bird on the way out. In the face of K.J. Wright being injured, not really being around for much of the season, Averill's gone, Bennett's gone, you have lost so many people. Maybe we're making an excuse for ourselves, but I don't think anybody thought, wow, you can lose all those guys and you're still going to be one of the most dangerous teams going into the final 3 weeks of the season.
Been remarkable. Been a remarkable thing. So, I mean, I think back to with the birds. I mean, we put it in the 12 Days of Christmas, the famous Earl Thomas middle finger.
Earl flips the birdie.
On the way off the field. I mean, a team that went through all of that, started the season 0-2. You have this controversy that won't go away in Thomas.
Yeah.
Breaks his leg. Now he's leaving the field. And there was this feeling of, okay, 0-2 start, resetting team. And not only are you just watching arguably your best player leave the football field for the rest of the season with a broken leg, he's calling you out on the carpet.
Yeah.
And maybe it wasn't directed, at Pete Carroll. Maybe it was just directed at the Seahawks sideline. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure it was directed at the situation that Earl Thomas was in.
No doubt.
And to have conversations on this show and to have many other conversations in which we debated how dangerously close is Pete Carroll from losing control of the entire thing, which had to have been a real threat at that point. And for him to have galvanized that group at that moment to have started to win in week number 3 and go 8-3 since that time, it's incredible.
Right.
And I love Anthony Lynn, and I love him a lot more today than I did yesterday for going for 2 last night. And I get the argument for Andy Reid, and he's an excellent football coach, and I think that usually at the end of the season he starts to shrivel a little bit in parts that shouldn't shrivel. If you're going to be a head coach, and maybe we'll see that again this year. And I also want to celebrate the coach who's the best. I don't care if he has great talent, like a Sean McVay has to be considered for this award. But this mountain of evidence that supports Pete Carroll's candidacy for Coach of the Year, not that it's the most important thing, Bucky, these postseason awards.
No.
I mean, what he's pulled off this year, in my eyes, is damn near unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. The big part to me, so I don't know how it works in an NFL clubhouse. I know what it's like in a baseball clubhouse. And it's one of those things where the manager is the boss. I mean, he's the big dog. He's a general. He's going to lead you out there, and you're going to do what he says to do. And if you don't, he will pull you from the team. He will exit you from the team, whatever might happen. The fact that some way, shape, and form, all of a sudden you got guys talking about reading books in meetings. You got guys that start to act like they're maybe bigger than the team, that individually they're bigger than the team. And whether it be money-wise or a combination of money, age, or any of those extracurricular type of things, he goes, sorry. As long as I'm the coach here, we're going to buy into my system. We're not going to think we're bigger than the process. We're not going to think we're bigger than what my idea is. He made some difficult decisions that made a lot of Seahawks fans uncomfortable, and they're panning out because I think that he somehow, in some way, shape, and form, got the group of guys that are left over to galvanize with the young guys that are now stepping into other people's big shoes to fill. And he somehow figured out how to get these guys to say, listen, the process works. It's proven, and it is proven. This stuff works. So he somehow, some way, some shape and form, losing all these people, has figured out how to make the team.
Well, there's no doubt that attitudinally he had to correct things, that he had some people that were rowing against the grain.
Right.
All right. So, yes, he had to make those hard decisions on people that I believe him when he says those are some of my favorite players I've ever coached, Michael Bennett's and Richard Sherman's of the world. So he had to make some difficult decisions in those areas. But he certainly, and I think that he had to kind of correct course, because if you're going to coach the way that he coaches and be a player's coach, I mean, how can you even sell yourself as a player's coach if the players don't like you or believe your message anymore? So he certainly had to cut that out. He had to cut a couple bruises out of the apple. But with that, and with all of the other things that happened to the organization, from Cliff's injury to Cam's injury, and you put them all together, it seemed illogical that a team that didn't make the playoffs could extract that much talent, veteran talent, from the roster. And even though they had a good nucleus with Russell and Bobby to build around, there still was the feeling of it's a rebuild. We're still going to rebuild, even though we are not ripping it all the way down to the foundation. You know, we got a strong foundation here. We're creating a new house.
Right.
You know, and so there's no question that I think he had to do that. That was absolutely essential to the health of the Seahawks organization, those difficult decisions that he made. But up until the Earl Thomas, that house was still divided. And in a strange way, when Earl Thomas left that field flying birds, there seemed to be a sliding doors moment. This organization can go one way or the other. They can galvanize around this moment. Maybe you've gotten that last guy that seems to be questioning your every move and motive. Maybe you finally got him out of the building.
Yeah.
Versus you're going to lose everybody because that guy with the birds and the broken legs and the middle fingers and the...
He was loved.
He was loved and certainly respected.
Yep.
And now you might lose the entire locker room at this point. And frankly, I think I felt like it's about ready to... The ice is going to break.
It most certainly
felt that way. It had to feel that way.
It felt like they were in thin ice, and they were heading in that direction. And somehow, I don't know if it's the Bobby Wagners, I don't know if it's Frank Clark's, I don't know if it's the Russell Wilson's, some way, or if it is just flat out Pete Carroll. They were heading on to thin ice, and somehow it has turned into a special thing again. I mean, I'm watching a special thing go on.
And then you watch Monday night. And then all of a sudden, I mean, that, I don't know, Slick Hawk could have to verify this or deny it. There was a different feeling about the victory Monday night than I'd had all season long. The celebration, everything. The fact that Frank Clark got so lippy afterwards. I mean, they were ready to crow. They were ready. They're like feeling themselves right now.
It's been slowly building.
It's been slowly building. And then there was like they were convinced. All right, we don't have anything to prove to anybody else. We're back.
You know where it started? The first game against the Rams, and they didn't win it, but there was that sense, and it started up front with those, with DJ Fluker, those guys up front, the fact that they could move them around, and that, then it kind of trickled, and then you saw it, you know, in the Detroit game. At the end of the Detroit game, there's a little bit of that cockiness, a little bit of that swagger, and it's just kind of slowly built now, and it's, I think it's the right amount. I think they're really feeling themselves the right amount. They're not like overhyped on themselves, but they know that they could play with anybody in this league.
Belief is a powerful tool, man. That is a powerful tool in life.
Powerful.
In the sports world. And man, I don't doubt any, I don't question any Seahawk fan that began to disbelieve in the direction that Pete Carroll was taking this organization. But now that it's worked out so well, boy, all the credit in the world has to go to him.
I would think. I mean, you're doubting him now, you got issues.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it just worked out. Maybe he caught breaks. I don't know. But you can't argue with the result. That thing looked like it was on the verge of a train wreck. And instead, Pete Carroll galvanized the locker room, turned him into a playoff team, and they are still building momentum as we speak. And that's a coach of the year if I've ever seen one. All right, coming up next, Walter Jones joins us. We'll get his thoughts on the issue. Sports Radio 950 KJR.
When you're high, you might make bad decisions, like trying to heat up pizza in the toaster. So it's definitely not the time to decide how to get home safe. To avoid a DUI or worse, make a plan before you party. Extra DUI patrols on now.
Ladies and gentlemen,
coming to you live on Seattle's original diehard sports station, Seattle Sports Radio 950, KJR. Now back to Chuck and Buck in the morning.
You know Dasher, and Dancer, and Prancer, and Vixen, Comet, and Cupid.
Sports Radio 950 KJR. I know nobody wants to hear fantasy football stories from the past. But that's pretty good.
I think you just told me like four people in your lineup and you had like 16 touchdowns.
It was like freakish.
Yeah.
It was one of those days.
I hope I do that to you.
Where the fantasy gods were smiling. Yeah, we play each other. I'm going to lose. I knew this was going to happen.
Yeah, take first overall.
I had the healthiest regular season I think I've ever had.
Yeah.
And then as soon as the playoffs start, I got six guys sitting out.
Yeah, I'm going to lose to 9-8.
Sounds awesome.
And that stink.
Yeah.
This is the reason I quit fantasy football and didn't play for 10 years.
Hey, I'll give you a high five. Maybe even a slap on the butt like an attaboy.
fact that you and Nate are going to be in the finals.
Hey. I don't like how you're putting me in there like that.
Joining us now is Walter Jones, the GOAT, here on Chuck and Buck in the Mornings. It's brought to you by Heritage Distilling. Hi, Walter.
How you doing, man? Good morning.
Walter, if you've ever given yourself to fantasy football, would you dare play it?
I never got a chance. I had a couple of friends that asked me to play it a couple of years ago, and I got into it. I was like, oh, I don't too much care for this. So I don't know too many players, former players that play it. So I never just really tried to get into it.
Well, I think maybe the problem why you didn't have so much fun is that you were trying to draft offensive linemen, and they don't really
score very well.
They don't score very well in fantasy football, Walter. No. Don't do that again.
You know, I tried. I had a buddy try that. We tried to start up a fantasy for offensive linemen. We tried to figure out how we could get offensive line points. If the offense scored this many points, if the offense scored this many rushing yards. So it just didn't pan out, so we just left it alone.
Yeah, you're not really getting pancake stats in fantasy football.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. All right, well, here are the Seahawks, and they are on the verge of wrapping up a playoff spot this weekend, Walter. And, you know, I think you had a lot more faith than some of us in the kind of season that this team was going to have this year. And we just had a lengthy conversation about Pete Carroll deserving Coach of the Year awards. How great a job, has he done with this team to get them where they are, considering everything they lost and all the hurdles that they've had to clear along the way?
You have to give him all the credit, because he kind of looked at what happened to the team last year and knew what it kind of saw what we had to fix. And I think the fix was the offensive line, getting a better offensive line coach and offensive coordinator. You know, and I think he knew the formula of what this team is built around, and that's a great defense, a great running game, and have a quarterback that you can trust in those tough games. And I think he did that soon as the season was over with last year. You know what I'm saying? I figured soon as the season was over, how quickly they changed those two positions, I knew that, you know, this team was going in the right direction of fixing this team, and I give all the credit to Pete Carroll.
Walter, I got to ask something, and this really doesn't even have anything to do with the Seahawks, and specifically right now. These guys are running the ball, and they're pounding it, guys. Everybody knows they're going to run, and they keep doing it. I just personally want to know, when you're an offensive lineman, and you line up, and you know you got to run play, they're running behind you, which they did a lot, because you're amazing.
Walter Jones.
Yeah. What does that look? When you look across the line and you see that other dude and he kind of knows, oh, here they're going to come at me again. Take me inside the mentality of what it feels like as an offensive lineman, because I think that that's something that the Seahawks are feeling right now.
I think as an offensive lineman, for me, I think you feel good. I think with any offensive lineman at this level, you just want them to run the ball behind you. You know, as we're prideful guys too, just like everybody else, just like the receivers, just like the running backs, you want your number called. So as an offensive lineman, when I played the game, I wanted them to call my number. Wanted them to run the ball behind me. You know, when I had Hutch, when I had Pete Kendall, when I had Chris Gray, all those guys, you know, anybody, you know, if a lineman look at the game, even though they might not admit it, but you want them to call your number. So at this point, I know the offensive lineman is feeling good because they are calling their number. You know, this offensive line been talking about for the last couple of years. So now for us to be talking about, you know, that they running the ball and they can run the ball effectively every game now. So you got to feel good. So as an offensive lineman, you feel good every time you line up that, you know, two or three times in a drive or four or five times in a drive, they're calling your number. And I think the running backs enjoy it too. You know, I think the thing about the running backs is they understanding the running game now and they knowing how to run, how to be physical when they run the ball. And you take your hat off to Pete, but you still have to take your hat off to Coach Solari, you know, from day one. Coach Solari has always been a coach where he makes everybody feel like they're part of the running game. So for me as an offensive lineman, I really enjoyed those moments when you call a play where you know that, hey, I got to get the block to make this play work.
No matter how many times a coach can bang it into your head, is it difficult for a player not to overlook an opponent on occasion?
It's very important. I think everybody looks at the schedule and looks at opponents and say, man, this should be an easy win, but you just got to take, you know, you have to take their mentality. You know, I think the thing that Pete does with these guys get on these interviews and they say the same thing every time. And so that's a sign of a great coach that, you know, they when they're in their meetings, when they're in their team meetings, he's repeating that to those guys, that, hey, we take one game at a time. And I think these guys does that, but still, that's a player. We still fans, and we watch TV, we watch everything that's going on. So it's kind of, you can kind of get it in your head that, hey, this should be an easy win, but then they still understand that you can go in here and have a letdown, and we definitely don't want a letdown right now. We just want to go out here and take care of business. So they should go in there and at the San Francisco and take care of business.
How fired up were you for George Fant's reception last week, and do you think that they should do that a lot more often?
I think it was cool, man. I think he got caught by the Turk monster, and that's what happened for us. You know, when we have to get light on our feet, that's hard for us as linemen. But we so used to keeping our feet to the ground. So I think that's pretty cool. I think if they keep throwing it to him, he'll get better, because, you know, that's what he started out as, a basketball player and a tight end. So I think it's kind of natural for him. But, you know, for the last couple of years, he's been trying to learn how to become an offensive lineman. So we're so used to keeping our foot low to the ground. So I think if he continues to keep doing that, he'll be catching more passes.
Well, I'd love to see like 8 catches for like 12 yards. You get Sunday. 8 catches for 12 yards for Fant Sunday.
Yeah, I don't think
2 touchdowns.
What?
Walt, thanks, man. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, man. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, Walter Jones, the GOAT, joining us here on the program. Of course, co-host of the fifth quarter on King 5 over there. So you get Walter's opinion. Every time you turn around, he's talking Seahawks. Well, talking it well.
Yeah, well, it's pretty amazing to be able to talk to a guy who literally is one of the best ever to do something. I am not
the
best.
And you get to do it every day. Isn't that amazing?
With you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not the best at anything in the world.
Yes, you are.
What?
Well, yeah, you are. Everybody's the best at something.
I don't think so.
Well, we'll figure it out before the end of the show. Yes. See?
I'm not.
It's just got to be something simple like that. You're just thinking too grand.
So far, I have not forgotten my key card to get in the building.
Okay. Well, maybe that's what you're best at.
I don't think I'm the best.
We'll figure it out before the end of the show. Everybody needs to know what they're best at. By the way, our conversation with Walter Jones brought to you by Heritage Distilling. You're very good at drinking BSB.
Oh, that's
true. You might be the best at it.
That's true.
You're right. Heritage Distilling is the proud home of BSB Brown Sugar Bourbon and Batch Number 12. It's just not football without Batch Number 12 vodka, bourbon, or gin. Drink, pass, repeat. Ocho's next.